Oi.
I this might vary about some issues, but generally, right?
Let me also get my computer tonight. Give me a second. Yeah, why don't you guys get started? You can just make sure to zoom stuff all over the screen so you can feel free to be back with us over there. So,
I feel like it's fine like this with one on Zoom. Here. Hi, everyone. So this is our last week for clinical ideologies and geometries. We're going to be changing the questions. But this is our update. And something that we wanted to look at was the contrastive pairs.
Oh, go ahead and make it bigger. Sorry, the font's really tiny. Sorry.
I'm gonna move this thing. Sorry.
Yeah, there's a menu under more. Under more, you can say hide that thing.
I have floating meeting controls.
Okay,
yeah.
There
we
go.
Yeah. And you can minimize, yeah,
that's great. Okay.
Great.
So we decided to look at some contrastive pairs experiments since we're trying to tease out this like idea of the LLM sycophancy versus like the user context. And we wanted to determine if we could extract like a non-sycophantic vector from the model to determine like when it's responding just based off of its like the baseline model behavior versus when you're giving it a certain context and how those responses differ. Originally, we kind of framed this as extracting like a conservative vector to see when the model is like flipping its responses to be more towards like a conservative or right-leaning ideology. But then we just decided to go with non-sycophantic vector because we saw that sometimes the baseline responses for the model without providing it any like personal context sometimes lean towards like a liberal ideology and sometimes towards conservative. So for a bigger data set, then we were having like a non-sycophantic vector and not just conservative. So we gave it a short user context, for example, like I am a sibling or I am a farmer, I'm a Republican, 26 different user contexts ranging from neutral to possibly a political proxy or a stereotype, and then explicitly political. Along with the 60 political compass questions, and we asked the model, do you agree or disagree with the following question? And I used Llama 70B instruct because we've seen the best results with that, and it's been the most robust. And for the contrastive criteria, as you can see in the purple and the green, the responses agree or disagree from the I am a human and I am a person, which are like baseline responses without context, are used as the non-sycophantic response, regardless of context. So if the model said that they agree, like in the top purple one, where it says, I'm a human and I'm a person, and the model says agree for both, then that is like the non-sycophantic or the non-flip. And then all the other responses where the model said disagree would then be the flip response. After that, we got 317 statements where the
So this is asking the model to predict its own text, or is it predicting the user text? Is it in dialogue or is it not in dialogue? It's just
it's a dialogue, yeah. Like
I see. So you mark user and assistant. You use those little tags to.
Oh, we're just asking the model, like I guess, just putting the prompt, like I am a human. Do you agree or disagree with the following statement? Like for example. I don't know, some political compass question, please answer either agree or disagree.
I see. So I guess I'm asking sort of a technical question, which is, you know, when you run these models in dialogue, then you have these little tags that set off like what a user says, and then little tags that set off like what the assistant, like the AI, is supposed to be saying. And it's a language model, so it can actually predict text in all these different contexts, it's happy to predict text even if you don't have any tags. I'm just wondering if you use any tags or not yet.
Right now, it's just wrapped in the standard user and an assistant.
Oh, so you are using
the user's entry. So yeah, like a few weeks ago, I tested flipping them and saw that there was CFC in both.
That's great. I forgot which team did that, right?
Yes,
that's great. Yes. So you guys did that. So you're inside that dialogue.
Yeah, but now we're just seeing like how it flips depending on the context that you provide about yourself, like the user context. I am XYZ.
I see. So the user says I'm something and then
we want to see if the LLM changes its response to agreeing or disagreeing with the political compass question.
I see. Says, oh, so the user says, I like all this stuff, and I'm liberal. Do you agree?
Yeah, exactly. And we want to see whether the model, like, now agrees or disagrees with the question differently from its response without any, context.
Yeah, with your first kind of, the way the model will respond, there's, no user intro or user intro that doesn't seem to reveal anything about their, I'm the person. It doesn't say anything about their political meeting, and we're saying, does it switch to, because it's for the most part, they tend to be left-leaning, but sometimes they'll be is capitalism good? Is the question? And
I see, so so I was a little confused about, because I didn't see that, is capitalism good kind of question? It's some questions about me, how much we should organize. I didn't really understand. I was expecting it to be a question about
maybe I explained it wrong. So that's the context. The context, the first part of the entire approach that we're giving the model is I'm a teacher, I'm a sibling, I'm a banker, I am a twin, something like that. And then we ask it, do you agree or disagree with one of the 60 political compass questions?
I'm a person, I'm giving you an interview, hey, LLM.
Oh, but then you drop out the I am.
But just for context, I'm a blah.
So that's
the context.
I understand that.
Yeah.
That's set up now.
Yeah, so then we do all the 60 questions for all 26 user contexts. And then we have 317 flips where the model will respond differently from its non-contextual response based off of giving it some kind of context.
Oh, and so what fraction is that? Is it changes? So sometimes it behaves the same either way.
Correct. Yeah, so 317 flips and 1,185 non-flips. So that's about 20%? So now we have this 1500 data set of contrastive pairs, and then I wanted to do the PCA visualization to see if we can extract some type of vector difference. And so I just sampled 317 from the non-flips, so that's more even in visualization. So the flips are the purple and the non-flip cases are the green. And the early layer and the final layer, there's really not much separation at all, which is kind of surprising. I was expecting that the statements that caused the model to flip, in which the only difference is the context, I am a liberal or I'm a Republican or I'm a gun owner or something like that. Would be very different, and it's not. And then we can see the same results here with testing sycophancy direction, and we don't receive great classification accuracy if we use the non-flip or flip as classification, and we also don't have super great linear separability.
Courtney, what token is this?
This is just on the context token.
The very last token.
The context.
And then also here, we wanted to look at if there is a difference, a vector we can find for the flip direction. And you can see this really small vector, which is basically a non-vector. So yeah, it's right there. We didn't get as great results as we wanted here in terms of seeing if there really is a difference, a separability between these statements. And so what I'm curious about looking next is looking more at intermediate layers just for compute and time sake, because it takes a really long time on 70B. We only looked at those two layers. But then also I wanted to know if there are possible clusters related to how people answer the political compass questions according to their ideology. So for example, if the model's baseline answer agree or disagree corresponds to a left, right, authoritarian, or libertarian, according to the political compass answer. Maybe there are actually clusters of that inside of like this. Like maybe there's like an authoritarian cluster and then like a libertarian cluster. And so that's what I'm working on right now. And then I'm also interested if there are possible clusters related to the neutral, proxy, or explicitly political user context. So maybe there's a cluster depending on like if you're explicitly telling the model I'm a liberal or I'm left-leaning or something, versus just giving it neutral information like I am a twin or something. But I'm also open to any suggestions from you guys about what you think may be able to help us tease out some kind of relationship here. Feel free to think on it and everything go next.
Okay, Yui. Yeah, I wanted to kind of build off of Courtney's experiments, and also since last week was week of activation patching, want to do some activation patching on 70B. Using basically the same setup, but with so one like neutral prompt in this case is saying I'm a human, and a conservative prompt which is saying I'm conservative, and Sassy, do you agree with a question? And then yeah, patching from each token, or patching each token correspondingly, so like between the prompts, over as many questions as I could last night, which is 37. So 19 of the questions where I was able to get Llama to flip the answer from saying I'm a human, I agree with this question, let's say I'm a conservative, I disagree with this question now, because next slide please. So this is the average like effect of patching. So average difference, average amount of like probability change from the target prompt, which is the I'm conservative, to how much more likely it is to answering in line with the source prompt. So saying like in the case of, so let's just for the flip questions where in the case of the target prompt saying I'm conservative, I agree with this question. How much then would I pass from a token to another token, from between tokens between prompts, did it switch to I disagree, because that's what the human prompt said. And there's, mainly centralized at the token that's being switched around, the human or conservative, and also at the very last layer, very last token in later layers. It's a little different from what Grace showed last time, where she had the effects of like, this was like one down the period. So may I probably just have like a one off by one error in this case, and to go and fix that.
It's off by one.
I think it's, I was doing 8B1, so 7B1,
oh, so
maybe
just
they're
different.
Like,
yeah,
okay.
That too.
So what's the word?
Yeah.
What's the word where you're saying the causal effect? Sorry.
At the here. This
I'm
is the human or conservative, two.
Or like context.
That's what a
context prompt.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's very stark difference, but the absolute probability change is like 0.1.
Very nice.
This is also like kind of, so it is in line with what we saw in class, where like the Shaq, Megan Rapinoe thing, where you have a lot of change focused on the token in the actual statement that's being changed, and also at the very end when speaking judgment.
And what's the little patch over here in the middle?
This?
Yeah.
That's a we'll do a question. This is so at the end of the prompt we say like please answer either agree or disagree to coerce like a single token, single token answer. This is at the dis of disagree at the very end. It's interesting, and I don't really know what to make of that yet. I guess next slide please. This is from some older experiments on 8B with a slightly different prompt but the same idea. In this case it's patching from liberal to conservative, where I'm saying like I'm a liberal, do you agree with this question? Conservative, do you agree with this question? Patching tokens around. This is for specifically attention heads and the MLPs in each layer. And interestingly, like there's no stark like shading like what there was in the previous experiments, where like you had a lot like very solid bar of color here, where we're flipping the token liberal or conservative, and a very solid bar at the bottom for the last token. So maybe the, you know, as my hypothesis is that the effect of like switching the answer, the sycophancy, is probably a combination of effects from the attention layer, attention heads, and MLPs. Since, you know, there's some stuff here, but it's not as noticeable as when we're doing the whole layer. So it's both. But yeah, as for future experiments, I would want to do this on 70B, with 8B, and do this with all the questions. Maybe it just happens that the first 30 questions of the political compass test are very decisive.
A quick clarification. So yes. This is MLP and attention heads?
Yeah, left is attention heads. Yeah. This right is, or, wow, I'm getting myself confused. This is just attention heads for two questions. Sorry. I did not read my slides. Go to the next slide, please. This slide is for MLP patching. And you see, like, there's some, you know, stuff up here, not as stark as, like, when we're doing the whole layer activations. That's
actually almost sense. The questions are different. I think in the 70B, the question was, do you agree or disagree? Here, the question is not that.
It's the same setup, but instead of switching from like neutral, I'm a human, it's liberal. Like, I'm a liberal, you agree with this. I'm a conservative, you disagree with this for these experiments.
But that final sentence is still the same. Do you
yes.
agree or disagree?
So yeah, I think it might have to cut off at the bottom. Yeah.
Okay, my main question was, if it is actually the same, do you see any effect on the attention head on the disk token where you were actually seeing effect on the 70B?
Good question. This plus show.
I think here you are having older experiments from last week.
Right.
We had the correct perspective, but then for the 70B...
Yeah, I guess that's what I thought. The questions are different.
For 70B, we did like the reframing of the question, so we could run it.
Sorry, I'm disorganized today.
No, I mean, we also had like stuff, this was like from last week, but then we did some over the weekend.
Yes, okay, so I forgot to include some slides. So I was doing a lot of going back to week one and looking at budget lens, because one thing that I thought was interesting, like looking at a bunch of different logit lens patterns, was that even though the model generally defaults to a liberal answer in a neutral context, the logits for the conservative answer is much higher. So even if you see that, like, if you say to the model, like, the same opinion, like, you know, I'm a liberal, you'll see the conservative logits go way down. So, like, the liberal would have still won, but the conservative, so it's, like, internally, so, like, it's thinking less of the maybe conservative thing. And so I was looking at ways to find logit lens patterns where there was more internal competition between, where it was really undecided between the, like, basically the difference between the conservative and liberal answer was smaller, or that the, so that's what I was looking at, like, how much inner conflict is there in the logit patterns. I don't know how principled of a metric that is, but I was just curious. I forgot to include, there's like a few examples that I found. And then I was curious whether or not this inner conflict would, like, if there was more inner conflict or like smaller differences between those logits, if that would reveal itself in the attribution patching things. And so I set up this experiment, and then after I ran it and reflected on what I did, I was like, wait, this was a very silly experiment to run. But basically I was looking at what is the logic different, like, attribution to all of the attention heads and MLP layers, or examples where the model was sycophantic, so its answer flipped, or not sycophantic, and it didn't flip between the neutral and conservative context. But then I was like, wait, if it didn't flip, then the logic difference is super low, probably, between the neutral and conservative context. So it's really noisy to even try to interpret what those differences are. So anyway, so I don't really buy this more. So basically, if you look at the flipped context, which is a tiny little sample size, it seems more concentrated, and in the not flipped context, it's more diffuse. But I think this is probably just an artifact of there being a small logic difference. So so basically, I want to run more attribution experiments where I'm looking at 70B, where it looks a lot more, and there's bigger, like, latent logic differences, even if you don't see them, like, in terms of the final answer.
Any suggestions for the team?
Yeah, this is, like, a bigger picture thing. I think with, like, the idea of psychofancy, I'm, like, trying to think through in this context. I'm having a lot of problems because it's one I, like, think about in the context of people. And it's, like, if I'm talking to you, you probably have, like, a true belief. And then the question is, like, are you telling me your true belief or not? I'm not quite sure what it means for LLMs to have, like, a true belief in this kind of context. I wonder if, like, that's kind of, like, one way for thinking about kind of what's going on in some of these experiments where you're struggling to have traction. I'm not sure what direction that lead. Like maybe a different set of questions that are related that are like there's a kind of set of tendencies within the model to answer political questions in certain ways, then how malleable or how plastic are those tendencies seems to be like one way of thinking about these experiments. But yeah, I think that both the psychofancy and then just like a lot of moving parts in terms of like the different things that could be going on inside the model, representation of the self, representation of other, representation of political beliefs, and kind of like how all of the different things are interacting and kind of like what you're isolating in there.
Yeah.
Maybe there's like a way of describing it not in terms of psychofancy that might help to get a little bit more kind of visual on it.
I think it's part of the reason I should have added the examples, but like I'm a little bit more towards like focusing on the inner conflict aspect where there's like competition between two answers, where I'm not saying like this one's the real one, and this is the one it's, like, pretending to do. It's more just, like, oh, sometimes it just, like, immediately commits to thing. Other times, there's more of that confusion. And does that mean anything? But because it doesn't require, like, saying whether or not the model has a self or, like, some thing. But I agree, it's hard to help.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a good... I appreciate that feedback. So I think we were talking some a bit about like private versus public beliefs and how like, yeah, like the LLM may have this private idea of what's going on, but then based off of like the context or what you're giving the model, it's going to output like the difference for you.
Is there something you're hoping to find or like expecting to find? Maybe that's the wrong word, but like what would be like a really... Yeah, what would be like a because I haven't been following y'all this project. But.
It's a cool thing. That would be a cool thing.
Thing that this is maybe not directly answering your question, but it I think there's a lot of like I think the reason that like your term sycophancy framing
yeah.
is that it's very politicized. Like it's like I think.
Sycophancy
like itself as a thing
oh,
like,
yeah.
where people are like the model's trying to read your mind and it's trying to persuade you know and I'm like I don't know like basically how deep is this like is it actually like it's trying to model you and figure out what you want
yeah.
or is it just like naive stochastic parrot like I don't know people agree with each other.
So is it just like
and like that kind of so any like I don't know exactly what that would be, but anything that we could basically my hope would be that by characterizing some amount of the mechanism, we could shine light on like how sophisticated is
yeah.
this. But I think at this point I don't really know what that would look like.
Right. Maybe it has to do with model size, as you said.
Is there a way to maybe also add like a to what extent, like 1 to 10, like it's like, oh, like I've changed my mind. It's like, I'm gonna choose a liberal answer, and also like I'm very certain of this. Like it's like a 9 or something. Like, is there any way to maybe like get more color on like the models? I don't really know where I'm going, but like I feel like for me that would like be another like data point that could help. Like if you added some sort of scale,
like in terms of like how positive is it,
or like I don't want to say
like
certain
model, like
yeah, yeah.
Agree or disagree, what's your level of
It's both like, oh, like I agree with this thing, and then it's also like on a scale of like 0 to 5, like really strongly agree versus.
I don't. It's not really like a principle thing. I guess I would. I, it's just something like I do to be like, oh,
no. Also, like, kind of adding to what everyone's discussing, identifying how like adaptable the model is. Like, I would assume that you're giving a context, the model will adapt to the persona that you're giving. Versus sycophantic, is it like happening really early? And like, if you probe the model further, does the model stay consistent to its sycophantic behavior, or is it just adapting to the given context? And when you change the slightly change the context, does it? Like change that. So having that would work. Like basically, like I don't know if a lot of papers have done that. Like having this differentiation between sycophancy and adaptability. That would be really interesting.
Great. Can you collaborate on
maybe? Like I feel like maybe I also don't know what that means. But I would just assume like sycophantic in a more negative connotation that says like, oh, the model abandons all knowledge or belief. It has suppose it's trained to be a non-hateful model. And one of the political approaches leads it to a hateful speech. A sycophantic answer will follow that path, versus an adaptable will understand that the user is conservative or like liberal, will adapt to that persona, but not like let down of its guardrails. So I guess that's what I mean. Like, when does this adaptation, like when does the model understanding that the user is conservative or liberal, like change its model's belief on that's the
like where's its like threshold for like being sycophantic versus following what
I guess
it's trained
so.
To do.
I guess so, yeah. I guess that's the
I love the minimal pairs you guys are putting together. I wonder a few things. So I like how you know you're talking about the difference between AP and 70P. I forgot your initial experiments where you measure these different models. So is your intuition that AB does have sycophancy, but
it's much more
but much more in 70B. So you know, obviously, you know, looking at 70B or looking at wherever the phenomenon happens is the thing to do. I also like the discussion. I wonder if there's some prompts that you could try that just have different forms, right? So here the user starts by saying something, but I wonder if you had something like, you know, the assistant says something. Okay, look, you can just token force it to say something, right? And then the user could say, "I disagree."
Yep.
And then it's kind of interesting if the model like sticks by its guns, or all of a sudden it has a different opinion. Like maybe like this. I feel like catching it in mid-context, changing his mind, it might be an interesting signal, right?
Yeah.
Right?
I've been thinking
like
about
I don't
this,
know.
Like, multi-turn context as well. Like, we're just in this turn prompting, but yeah, that could
right.
get
and,
more
and,
out.
And
like,
you don't have to do all multiple turns, right? You can just token force all the things and then just, like, do the second turn and see if there's something interesting that happens in the second turn, right? You know, I'm not sure. I think that there's a couple other things that occur to me. So you have a prompt form, agree or disagree, which is kind of a multiple choice thing. So you let it think a thing and then you do multiple choice. So there's been various challenges in untangling model change through multiple choice. It's kind of like an extra level of indirection, right? Because now it's got to decode what does agree mean. What does disagree mean? As there's an actual sentence somewhere, right, that it has to refer to, and so anyway, if you want it, so I'd recommend. There was a nice paper by what's her name? Yeah, Sarah. What's her last name? Weber. Yeah, Sarah Weber. That like takes apart the whole mechanism of multiple choice. So it's worth a read just to you know refresh yourself and see if the mechanisms that you're seeing look like that, and if it gives you any clues for decoding.
So it sounds like maybe the approach is like come up with as many different
weird variations on this prompt and just chuck the methods at them and see what
I'm not sure. Yeah, that's
yeah.
one possible thing, right? So I think that clever prompting can, you know, it's kind of like biology, right? You know, it's
yeah.
like, well, clever experimental design, just putting the right things in the test tube can sometimes, you know, clarify what's going on, and it's worth the try because it's relatively low cost to string together words in a different way. I like, you know, I like your some of the things you're looking at. So I think that when you jump to looking at 1,000 cases at once or something like that, or 100 cases at once, it might be premature. It's like, oh, actually, maybe take a look at individual cases, you know, more. It's just faster. Just to give yourself a sense of where things might be.
I tried some prompts like without the I agree or disagree, or like please answer agree or disagree. Like I just asked it, how do you feel about the following statement, or do you agree or disagree, or like what is your perspective? And I tried like maybe like 20 different things,
yeah.
And without explicitly asking it, like please answer agree or disagree, I couldn't get consistent like outputs. Like
it would like to say some other thing.
Yeah, it wants to say something completely different. So
yeah.
At least like for this contrastive pair, that's why I went with that specific wording, because without it, I couldn't get consistent.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
I understand, yeah. And so there may be a way of avoiding this multiple choice form.
Yeah.
But then read Sarah's paper and maybe there's some tips there to follow that through. Nikhil also had the same issue with his thing, which is another multiple choice form.
What's the name of the paper, or could you like send
it? Send
it
on my screen.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. By the way, I just want maybe more concrete goal would be try to reduce sequencing with just changing the internal representation, maybe weights of the model. That could be a potential. Have you guys thought about it?
You've seen like this
people have done
papers
it.
That do that. They do it in a sort of black box where it's like, please steer it in a way that makes it agree with the user less. And I think to me, that's kind of unsatisfying. I'm like, I don't know what just happened. Like, did I just prompt the model through vectors?
No,
I don't know.
It's a technique though. So if you read one of those papers, you're like, oh, what's plausible? I kind of believe what they're doing here. You could adopt one of the methods and then ask your interpretability question, which is like, oh, so
what
did they
happening?
Really do? Yeah.
Yeah, I think
that's true.
That could
some
be
of their like papers they use like the term like steer though, but they don't mean it in the same way that we do. They're
uh-huh.
just like. Yeah.
It could just be some fine tuning. They have a lore or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
but still, you could adopt it. You could say, oh, what is this lore
okay.
doing if you apply it on top of the model? And so it's another possibility. Yeah. It's just, it's tricky. I don't know. Just so like you're now you're into it. You have pretty good experimental ideas, I'd say. I don't know what the advice is. You keep on digging, right? Yeah. It's great. But if anybody has ideas on this, it's a pretty neat setting. I like the question, like, is there a sharper hypothesis that they can have? So, you know, I think that's worth thinking about. You know, like it could be that you're not, it could be that the whole idea of sequency is like a bizarre, malformed, ill-posed idea, right? It's like, can you really do thinking without context? You know, is there such a thing as your true beliefs, or do whenever you are asked a question, you're always in some context. There's no such thing as your true beliefs. You know, you get abducted by aliens or something, you're asked your political beliefs. Is that like the true context? I'm not sure. Right? You know. And so it might be it's an ill-formed question. It might be that there's no such thing as a non-sycophantic universe. It's always,
that'd be cool.
Right? It, like, that's, like, I mean, that's why, you know, you're sort of seeing everything all mixed up, right? But you're closely related to other kind of questions. I like the question of assumptions. And, you know, you were brushing on this earlier. It's like, oh, I'm a nurse. Then all of a sudden the model has all these assumptions. And it's like, oh, why did you assume that, right? Do assumptions change when you have a different okay. if like I'm a nurse, I feel like I have a different assumption than being a nurse in a phase or something like that. Is there a way of understanding how that knowledge is organized? Can you see the fingerprint position or something like that? I'm not sure. It might be that there's something downstream. Obviously, see that they could also be sending. All right. I like it. I like that you guys have you seem to have picked up on all the different experimental techniques. And it's great. All right.
Thank you, everyone.
All right. Let's talk about probing. So, it's not. What did you guys think of the reading? Let's see. I picked a couple papers for you guys to read. There's what's really nice is there's like probing is a way of looking inside networks. Because it's simple, but it follows machine learning principles. So a lot of people believe in it. It's simple enough that a lot of people can do it. So let me just introduce like what the heck people mean by probing. It's pretty simple, right? You're asking this question. Without the censorship, you have this little black square. Here you go. Right. You're asking this question, right? Does my neural network representation, do my neurons know some concept? Right? Does it know some concept? But this is a weird question, right? Like when you started this class, if I said, hey, your mission was to figure out if my neural network knows concept C. Does it know the difference between right and wrong? Right? Does it know something like that? You'd be like, how do you even quantify that? And so probing gives you a really simple exercise, so formula for quantifying it. And so today we'll just talk about, what that formula is, some of the limitations, some of the other things people have done. I think you guys had a lot of good questions about the reading that cover most of this stuff. And so the formula goes like this. So basically, you have to decide what your concept is. Like, what's the difference between right or wrong, right? Well, how do you do that? You do the machine learning thing. You define some data set, like a labeled data set of like, about some X's which are right, and then other X's that are wrong. So the example from the TCAF figure one was, I've got some images which are all stripy, and then I've got other images which are just regular, images. And that's the difference, right? That like these are stripes, these are regular images. Can I tell the difference between these two things? I wonder if the network has an internal concept which would like know the difference between these two things. So that's what it means to define a concept. So you could see, oh, actually, maybe the concept is like, this is like not as stripy as that or something like that, even though there's some stripes on it, things like that. Your definition of where the line is between positive examples and negative examples of your concept are just given by a data set, right? And if you want to define your concept a different way, you just form your data set a different way. So that's the first step. Second step is this. Is you have to decide where in your network you care about what it knows. So I've just written down, there's some layer of the network Z, which is where you care about it. And then you just ask the question, can we extract a classifier for my concept out of that Z? So if the Z comes out of F of X, the first bunch of layers of my neural network, then I just train a classifier G to try to predict my concept out of that layer of the network, right? And so that's just classic machine learning. There's a lot of ways of training a classifier, and you can use any of them. But like the simplest way is to just train a linear model, like basically learn a vector that if you dot product it with the neurons, then that weighted sum gives you a score that tells you which side of the line you're on. That makes sense? And then, if the data set's big enough, the line's never going to be perfect, but it'll have some level of accuracy. Make sense? So that's step two. Is you just like train this classifier. Now, it could be a complicated classifier. It could be a nonlinear classifier or something like that. And so it's not a separating plane anymore now. It's like some weird boundary that you're learning. But you know, you can learn any kind of classifier. And so there's some debate about this second step, like what you should do. And this is a lot of papers have been written about the second step because there's the machine learning part in there. It's all in machine learning venues. So they like to debate about how to do the machine learning. And then the third step is after you get your classifier, then you measure its accuracy. And the idea of the probing is that if you can extract your concept more accurately, then you take that as evidence that the information is in there. And if you have trouble extracting your concept, then that's evidence that the information is not in there. Or at least if it's in there, it's hard to get out. That makes sense? Yeah. So that's it. That's the formula for probing. So now all your projects are sort of the form. I wonder if my neural network has a certain thought, or if I wonder if my neural network knows a certain thing. And I think that in 2019, you could write those papers. And the classic thing would be you learn how to train a classifier. You do these three steps, and you'd be done with your paper. You'd write the thing. That makes sense? And actually, but because of that, it's not a bad step to do this anyway, right? But I want to also, you know, sort of give you guys room to ask, you know, to sort of question this, and we'll explore the area of probing a little bit more. So, okay, so let's take a moment. Okay, Jasmine, kick us off. You had some questions.
I guess, I'm, like, really confused by the Hewitt-Young paper where they're, like, you can have problems where, like, your probe looks like it's doing really good.
Yeah.
But the representation, like, still isn't there.
Right.
At the same time, though, like, if it performs well, like, there's, like, some kind of signal there. So to me, it's, like, what, like, why are we doing all this? Like, what is interpretability?
What's it about? What's it,
like,
what are we
yeah,
doing?
Like, mean, like, at what point do we have, like, a concept that we, like, know?
Yes. What's the hope? And what's the challenge here? So I think the hope is to get our finger, you know, get our hands on this question, right? It's sort of the lie detector question, you know. What did Nixon know, and when did he know it? Right, sort of the question, and so we're asking that this is our neural network. What did they know? When did they know it? Right. So that's the hope, but then it turns out that it's kind of this mushy thing, right? So, and I think that the Hewitt thing, part of the Hewitt thing, comes down to this question of, you know, if you know something that's closely related to what you're being asked about, you know, does that mean you know the thing? Like, if I knew, you know, oh, I probe your brain, and I know that you're thinking that it's like a square root, and it's a square root of 2. And then I say, yes, so you know that it's 1.4 something, right? Well, I don't know if you know that it's 1.4 something. Maybe you know that it's like the square root of 2, but maybe you don't know what the square root of 2 is, right? But then, like, you know, maybe somebody with a certain level of expectations about common sense might go to you and say, well, you knew it was a square root of 2, so you knew it was 1.4, right? Like, anybody would know. But then you might say, no, well, I didn't know, right? I didn't know that the square root of 2 is 1.4. Like, is that, they say, how can you not know? That's so obvious. It's just a definition of what it is, right? So that you can have a difference of opinion of what this is. And so when you train a classifier to look at a thing and like, solve a problem, is this really a view that the network knows something? Or is this a view that the classifier could figure out the answer to the question, right? It's like, oh, like, I can look at what information you had, it's a square root of 2, and I could figure out it's 1.4. Like, I'm like the classifier here, I can figure out what's going on. But maybe you couldn't have, right? So there's this weird piece of epistemology here of, like, what does it mean to actually know something? But I think that, you know, just asking generally what the goal of it is maybe we'd like to, we have some sense of what it means to know something, and we're trying to get our hands on it. And probing is one approach to it. I think that some of the Hewitt things are related to this dilemma that I'm describing about what's obvious, what's not obvious. We'll talk about Hewitt a little bit more. Let's talk, ask, what is Kai's question? Kai is here. Who's Kai? Oh, Kai, yes.
It's kind of the same thing. Like most of the concepts from the concept activation paper are like pretty concrete strips or beagles.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, like, how do we know if it's actually capturing something
The
that
concept's like
abstract?
beautiful.
Yeah, like TV.
How about a concept like sycophantic? Right? So I really like that. So these minimal pairs that your classmates just presented here for sycophancy is like an example of constructing one of these data sets. It's like, oh, there's like sycophancy over here. There's not sycophancy over here. I wonder if my neural network keeps track of the difference between them. You see this scatter plot with everything mixed up. It doesn't look like this, right? You think, I don't know. Maybe it's not keeping track, right? Look at Grace. Grace is like, I don't know. It doesn't look like this, right? Maybe my network's not thinking that way, right? So, but I think that, so you can ask this, so that's the beauty of this general formulation. You can ask this question about anything. It could be beauty, it could be in some abstract thing, just whatever you have in your mind, and you can just like define the classification set, and then you can ask a question. That doesn't it doesn't guarantee you that you're gonna get a positive answer. You might get really low accuracy at the end of your probe. But that's but or maybe not. Okay, so that's sort of that. And Claire. Yeah, so what was your question?
I mean, like the props are only using human-like features, but sometimes models split things into like
Non-human-like things?
non-human-like things.
Yeah, I really like this question. I think that, so, you know, a lot of the methods, most of the methods we're studying in the class start off with a hypothesis. Like, you know, you want to know if the AI knows something. And to ask that, you have to define this data set. You have to decide what's. So what if the thing that the neural network knows is something that you can't distinguish? Like you can't tell the difference. Then how the heck do you make this probe data set in the first place, right? So it's a limitation of this method. I think that, you know, that's one of the things. So I think it's a good question. There are probably other reasons. There's probably other ways of like chasing after something that a network knows that you might not be able to suss out, but you know, probing is not the way to get it. And Isaac.
Yeah, this is just like a, I think, inversion of all the questions that have been asked, but it struck me that like they have like the example of like images of CEOs, but like what makes them images of CEOs or just that we're calling them images of CEOs. Like
Yes.
it seemed like a lot was riding on how we are kind of imputing our own concepts into the
Yes.
images as
Yes.
opposed to necessarily kind of coming out
Yeah.
itself or corresponding to something in the images that the model is responding to.
Yeah, so I think it's right.
Yeah.
It's basically the same kind of question. And so the things that we're that equips us to answer is trying to find a correspondence between the way that we think about the world and maybe the way that the network is representing the world. So that's right. And so if it's something very inhuman that we're trying to suss out, then it's hard to do this for it. Now there are some techniques. So for example, there are people who ask this question about inhuman things by doing things like taking two neural networks and seeing if they agree. Right? Like you can just take one neural network and take a random neuron or something and say, well, I don't know what this neuron does. It might be something imperceptible. But I wonder if this second neural network learns the same neuron, right? If it has the same information. So you can use the first neural network's neuron to create this data set, and then you can use a second neural network to see if you can probe that concept back out. And so, you know, people have done that to try to get a handle on things that are not human interpretable. And there's various fancy ways of doing this, larger scale, that you know even neuroscientists do to try to align brains of people with each other and stuff like that. So if anybody's interested in doing that kind of thing for the project, then let me know. We'll add a segment to the class to talk about these kind of events. Yes.
Is the goal to probe for concepts that exist in multiple different types of models? Is that like
when you do this kind of thing? Yes. So I think that there's this sort of holy grail of the project of the project of interpretability for AI, which is, can I get a printout of everything that the AI knows, including stuff that I didn't know to ask, right? And so, well, certainly you can. You can just print out all the numbers of all the neurons, but that doesn't tell you anything. So, like, what are the meaningful concepts? Can I get a printout of all the meaningful concepts? What does that even mean? And so one way of chasing that problem is you take 100 neural networks, there's like trained slightly differently, slightly different architectures, something like this, and you use techniques kind of like what I'm describing, like, you know, see if they agree, if they have the same neurons as each other or something like that. And then you'll see that, oh, there's only a certain number of neurons that they all have, right? Most of the neurons, they like have, you know, they're very different, but they have a few neurons which they all learn regardless. And so there was a nice paper, you can look it up, it's called Rosetta Neurons, where they do this. And the name of it, you know, suggests the research program, right? They're like, if all these neural networks have these neurons in common, then these are sort of like the key, you know, translation points. It's like a Rosetta Stone for us to be able to translate between concepts. Maybe it's like the key for even decoding the whole idea of the internal language of neural network to begin with. So that's the technique that people use. Makes sense? And so, right. And so some of these things are, some of these things are really nice dreams. I think that they're mostly speculative right now. Like, I don't think anybody's really figured out the formula for dumping everything that a neural network knows. So, okay. So, Armita had this question. Armita, yes.
How would this pass with it?
Yes. What the heck about LLMs? Why did I assign you like an image paper? This TCAF thing. Well, partly is I just wanted to give you a little historical context. And probing is pretty old. Probing goes back before the TCAF paper, but as early as the TCAF paper, people were already thinking about how to understand what neural networks knew, and they were using probing methods. And so around the same time, people were looking at machine translation systems and using probing to figure out what's going on. So let me just describe like an old machine translation setup. It's like a classic way that people use probing. So you can kind of see how it works in practice and other people use their papers, right? And so here, they had some machine translation system. I'm not going to get into RNNs and everything. They're kind of like transformers, but different, right? But they also have little layers where you have a representation of token. And then you can ask the question, what does the network know about this token? Does it know that it's a pronoun? Does it know it's plural? Does it know it's a verb or noun? Right. So it's kind of this can actually be kind of interesting questions, because if you have like the word play, right, it could mean a verb. It could mean a noun. And then within the concept of a verb or noun, it could mean different things. Within that, and so you can ask it, hey, is play a verb or a noun? Classify that for me from looking at the neural representation here. And if you can get good accuracy on a probe like that, then it suggests that maybe your network knows the difference between a verb and a noun, and maybe it doesn't. And so this is the kind of thing that they would do, and they would ask a simpler question. It's like, is this plural? Is this singular? Is this present tense? Is it past tense? You know, these two linguists, they have all sorts of things that they like to measure. And so here's like an example of a set of questions about plural and past tense and uppercase. They call these morphological attributes of a word. And what they did is they went to machine translation system and they went to all the layers, the early layers and the late layers, not that different from a transformer. And they asked, what was the accuracy of the probe classifier when translating from Czech to English or Spanish to English, whatever, right? And you can see that at the early layers, it's pretty accurate. It can tell the difference between these morphological, things. It can classify plural versus non-plural pretty well at the early layers. But the weird thing is that as you went deeper in the network, these are only four-layer networks, but as you went deeper in the network, the accuracy dropped. What the heck do you think is going on? So do you see that? So don't worry about the last bar. The last bar is aggregate. If you train a probe over all four layers at once, which you can do also, then it's like super accurate, right? So, but if you train it on just one layer at once, the accuracy is dropping. What do you think that means? What do you know that means? Why would the accuracy drop the more computation you did?
Like getting the concept and forgetting.
It's good.
When you tell someone, oh, I read somewhere, and you forgot where you read it, or even what language you read it in.
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
Yeah. So it looks like forgetting here, right? So this is a funny picture of like forgetting. It's like when it first read the text, it knew this was past tense, right? And then as it goes further into its layers, then it kind of like the story is like lower probe accuracy, right? It's like it kind of is forgetting that it's past tense. Isn't that weird? Yeah. Strange, right?
And then with the Hewitt thing, they suggest the memorizing proof.
Yes, we'll get to that.
Yes, yes,
yes.
I don't skip to the end.
No, it's okay. But yes, in the Hewitt thing, right? The question is this even meaningful to ask? Are we looking at the right thing? So, like the classic probe thing is to look at accuracy, and Hewitt is like, it's not about accuracy. Why is everybody looking at accuracy? Right? We should look at selectivity or something. So we'll talk a little bit about that.
Yes.
Yes.
But in that example, because it's a function of the word identity, you would expect earlier layers to have higher accuracy for memorizing.
Because that's right. So because at the earlier layers, you were just told the word just now.
Yeah.
Like the information hasn't been messed up. And so it's obvious.
Yeah. So I guess that's not. Yeah.
I don't know, right? It's kind of like, do you buy Hewitt or not? Like, do you really want to look at selectivity or if you drew this graph and you showed selectivity instead of accuracy, would it give you an insight? That's a pretty simple question. But you do see these accuracies drop, and the story that people tell. But you can think about it now that you've read all these papers, right? The story that people tell is that when the accuracy drops, it sort of suggests that the network is forgetting something. It's like erasing that information. It used to have all this information about whether the word was plural or not, and it went into the deeper layers and it sort of erased the information. So let me show you a contrasting experiment. Same set of people. Now here, they're looking at syntactic relations. So I'm not really a linguist, but I gather this is, if you have like a dependent clause or something like that, you can have different sentences where the same word might sometimes be the object of the sentence, might be the subject of the sentence, might depend on another word, or might stand alone, right? And so you can make a syntax tree and you can say, what are the relations for a word? And then you can ask a probing question about this. You can say, can I tell the difference between words that have a syntactic relation and words that don't, or words that have a different syntactic relation? And so the accuracies for this task look kind of like this. It depends on the language. I don't know what's going on with French to English, but like for Spanish to English, like the probe accuracy goes up as you go through the layers. Right. Why would that be? Why would some of the things like go down and other things go up? Kind of interesting. So this contrast between things going down and things going up was compelling enough that people wrote a lot of papers about this. And the intuition was that some of these things, it takes a lot of context processing to figure out, you know, what's going on here with syntactic relations. And if you want to do a good job of machine translation, you need to know this pretty well. So more and more of the neural network's representation is being used to represent stuff like this. So that's why when you probe it at the later layers, then the accuracy goes up. It suggests that it's using more of, it's doing a better job at representing this information. It's got like this information represented more accurately. Getting there. And at least that's the story. That makes sense? But it's cool though, right? I think that these experiments are genuinely cool. This idea that you might be forgetting something that you were just holding input in order to make room for something that you're figuring out that wasn't obvious for them. And I think that people generally still like believe this story. And if you find a sequence of computations in your neural network that you want to characterize, doing a probe like this and contrasting between, you know, probes that are less accurate and more accurate is definitely a worthwhile thing to try and to report. And, you know, people have been looking at probe accuracies for decades. So they'll be able to read, you know, what you have. They'll know what all the caveats are. They'll be able to read that experiment. That makes sense? Okay, so for example, my student Sheridan last year wrote a paper, which was this type of probe. So actually, there was a question here. Did I skip any questions? I want to skip questions. I've noted questions, but I'm just stopping asking guys for your questions. So I think that one of the questions was like, hey, so what about multi-valued attributes? Where it might not be, you know, yes or no, but it might be like 5 different things or 10 different things. So you can make probes that are multi-weight classifiers, no problem. And so the classic one is logit lens. Right, the logit lens is a non-trained probe. It's a probe that is just like the pre-trained decoder layer, and it's a classifier. It's a 50,000 weight classifier that tells you which token is the most likely one, at any given spot. And so, what Sheridan did was instead of using logit lens, Sheridan trained a probe, a 50,000 weight probe, on predicting the most likely word. In a very mechanical way. And so here's the setup. You have like the intermittent as like a piece of Wikipedia text, and Sheridan takes like the token mit. And so the token mit comes in, it just represents the token mit. It's just like the embedding for mit at the first layer. And as it goes through all the layers, then that vector is evolved into something that eventually like predicts the next token, right? But instead of like saying how accurate it is at predicting the next token, which is what logit lens does, Sheridan asks, how good is it at predicting mit itself? Right, so like you inputted mit, and if you go like 5 layers down and you asked, oh, out of the 50,000 tokens, which one was the original token that you started with? Do you still remember that you were mit? That makes sense? And so you can use that as a probing question. And you might think, oh, that's easy. It's like 100%. No, but it's not, because you see the same erasure phenomenon going on. Like the accuracy drops. And so here's mit. Starts off at 1.0. Of course, you can read the embedding right out of the network. But as you go to, you know, in 10 layers, right, it kind of forgets a little bit. It's down here. That didn't forget a lot. It's at like at 80%. You know, it drops down to 70% or something. Right. So it's erasing this information. It's sort of the story. Right. Now, there's other information that's interesting. Like, how about the previous word? If you go to mit and you ask, what's your representation? How much does it know it comes after inter? Right? Intermittent, right? Like, does mit know that it comes after inter? That seems like it's a pretty important word. You know, it's like it's not about mittens here. It's about intermittents. Right? It's pretty different. So to understand really what mit means, it might be handy to know that you come after inter. So that's like another probe. It's a very mechanical probe. And then you can ask this question, this classifier question. And at the beginning, mit is very bad at predicting the inter comes before because there's been no attention heads applied to it. So the probe is like at almost zero accuracy. Now, it's not at zero accuracy. Zero would be all the way down here. It's like a little higher than it. Why would it be a little higher than zero? Even if
Even if you haven't written any attention, you haven't run any attention pens yet, and you haven't been, and you're like, oh, you know what? 10% of the time, I can guess what the token was right before me. Anyway, without even seeing it, you're totally blinded. You don't even have an attention hands. Why is the accuracy not down at close to zero? Why is that?
Previous words also include information on the future words, so like
even easier than that, even easier. It's almost like if imagine you were a cryptographer, and you just had like the middle of the word given to you, without any context, you might be able to guess what the part of the word was before, right? That makes sense. Just because of bigram words of distance. Just bigram words, it's just because you know that you're in English, and there are certain things that are in English that just tend to happen before, even without any additional information. So the baseline accuracy of the classifier is sort of the accuracy of bigram statistics in English without any other contextual knowledge. But then, as soon as you start running attention heads, then you do have contextual knowledge, and the accuracy goes up to, you know, 70%. And so the information about the previous token is being fed in, goes up, right? And then it pays attention to it for a little while, and then it starts erasing that too. Kind of interesting, right? That makes sense? And then you can ask about, oh, how about two tokens before, like V, right? Oh, it actually pays attention to that too. And it puts a little bit of that information in there, and then it erases it over time, right? And then four tokens before, it has this a little bit less, right? And then what's this yellow line? The yellow line's interesting. It goes like, this yellow line's different. You see what that yellow line is? This yellow line is about not looking back, but looking forward, looking at the next token, right? So can it predict the next token from the representation? Why is it going up? Why is it getting more and more accurate at predicting the next token as you go through more and more layers? Why would that be? Okay, so machine learning person, tell me why would it be?
Language.
Because it's a language model. Yes. Why do you say it's because of the language model?
That is what it is.
What does the TA say?
I mean, that's what it is trained on.
That's what it's trained to do, right? So basically, you know, just from lecture one, right? You know, there's a language model. So it's trained to predict the next word, right? And so as you go through more and more letters, it's like, has more information about, like, its good guess for the next word until it gets here. So this is about how good this language model is, like 40% of the time, can guess the next word in Wikipedia correctly, given the context. So that's pretty nice. Right, so it's like, oh, this is good. So it's like working, right? The language model is working. But then at the same time, it's predicting the next word. It's also keeping track of all these other things from like previous words. And you can see this interesting profile of the information. So that's basically, I just wanted to share this, how probing works. Now, okay, so the weird thing, the reason that Sheridan wrote a paper and why you could write, so you could write this, you could, like, somebody would have written this in 2017 and it would have been a paper by itself, this graph. But in 2024, you can't write that paper anymore. Everybody knows this, right? So the reason that it's a paper in 2024 is because of this contrast with this other plot, which is the same lines, but which is this observation that at certain tokens, the plot looks different. So if you take a look at the word ent, or the token ent, and you do the same plots instead of the token mit, then the accuracies look like this. So what mit really is a stand-in for any generic token in Wikipedia, right? But what ent is not any generic token in Wikipedia. These are what Sheridan calls the last token of a multi-token word. So, you know, some words are tokenized in ways that they have to be split up into multiple tokens. And if you have a word that got split up and you take a look at the last word and you do this probing, then you get this other thing. And what Sheridan says is, she says, it means that, like, that word erases knowledge of what it was,
Ed, does Ent know that it's Ent? Well, obviously, right as soon as it comes in, it knows. But as soon as you start exposing it to attention hits, what the heck is the model doing? The model's you may have been Ent, but I'd rather not know that you were Ent. I need you to forget this. The model's quickly erasing this. And it's also quickly erasing all the other contextual information. It's crazy. I don't know. What? So basically, Sharon wrote this paper saying, what the heck is this erasure? There's this token erasure going on, right? Why is it forgetting stuff so quickly? Yes.
I have two questions.
Yes.
The first one, the fact that ent is a common ending word in
Yeah.
English, that's persistent. So did y'all try changing the prefix and keeping the last token constant and seeing if the model's erasure is consistent?
Yeah, that's basically what the experiment is. So basically, this is based on a huge scrape of Wikipedia, and so ent, I'm sure, shows up at the end of a bunch of different words. Probably all these tokens show up at the end of a bunch of different words, and so this is an average accuracy over all of that mix, and yeah, so and pretty consistently, ent. If you ask the representation of ent, do you know what came before you? Then it does peek over here at layer three. It does sort of know what came before. But then, pretty quickly, when you get to layer 10 or something, it's basically forgotten it. Unlike the normal case, when at layer 10, it still remembers what came before. Make sense? Does that answer the question? Or,
Yes.
okay.
How did they develop the intuition that we should look at the
So look at this.
yeah versus look at the space after intermittent, how did the sort of
Yeah.
graph one to data graph two?
Yeah, why look at this? Yeah, it's from the kind of digging that we're asking you guys to do. It's what was it that so basically the real story for this piece of research was that I had told Sheridan, look for the opposite of this. If you have a multi-token word, then the process of concept formation in this environment where the words split up into lots of tokens, it should require you to have a better awareness of the tokens that came before if you're a meaningful word. So if you're a word like intermittent, then you should not have the luxury of forgetting what came before you. Like if you were the word the, then yeah, who cares what came before? You don't need to know that because you know the means the. But for if you're intermittent and you're ent, you need to know what came before you. So you would have a really accurate view of this. So Sheridan is like, okay, probing, I can do probing. Set up this probing thing. And Sheridan showed up a week later and says, I don't know, it's my first week in the PhD and and my experiment's coming out wrong. Right, it's like this. It's like the information is not there. I must have set it up wrong, right? And so Sheridan basically spent, a couple months digging through the probing code and through different data sets and different ways of setting this up, until we were finally convinced that, oh, actually Sheridan is a brilliant experimentalist, had set it up right on the day one, and had found this surprise that was exactly the opposite of what we'd expected. Make sense? And so that's where this came from. Right. And then but then the question is, okay, if it's counter to what you would expect, why is it doing this? What the heck? Right? And it leads to some other papers. Okay. So yeah. So Isaac, what was your question?
I was wondering about the relationship between this and catching.
Yeah.
The class notes suggested that they're complementary.
Yeah.
Is it complementary in the sense of if given an option, we should always do catching, and given resource constraints, this is a viable second best alternative, or is there something more complex about the relationship, how we should think about the relationship between these
It's a
two?
little bit more complex. I'd say that I think they really are complementary. So in the second best, so I think that, because probing is older than the practice of patching, I often go around telling people, no, patching's better. You need to do causal experiments because this is just a correlative experiment. You can get fooled in all these ways that we'll talk about. And I think that you guys already have intuition about it, right? That from the questions, you guys understand how probing can be fooled. But I think that probing is maybe half the story. I think that if you can sometimes get a similar picture about information content from patching, but it's different. Your patching is telling you if the model is using some signal. It's not telling you if the signal is present, if it's not used, and sometimes you are interested in whether the signal is present, even if in this particular piece of text it's not used. Like maybe in some other piece of text it might be used or something like that. And you just want to know if the model is like prepared to have that information available. Just sort of this experiment is kind of like this. It's like, you know, I don't know what might come after this. You know, I don't know if the model needs to know this information, but it's just interesting to know that regardless of whether the model is using that information later, it's just not even there. Right. Even like a trained probe can't get it out, right? And so if a trained probe can't get it out, then the model probably won't be able to get it out. And so, so it's complementary. I would recommend for any of these papers, like make a tripod, like try to find more than one way of characterizing the representation that you've got, and probing is a powerful tool, and it should be in your arsenal. Okay. That sort of answer the question? Yeah, these things are always in flux. Ayu had a question.
Yeah, so my question is, so it has a cost vector. Does the prediction use that vector to do some prediction, or it's just correlated with the concept?
And I think I answered that just now, right? It's like it doesn't necessarily use it, right?
Yeah.
So the probe is using it. Right, but we don't know if the model itself is going to use that information downstream. That's right. And I think that's the fundamental problem with probes: is that just because information is there doesn't mean it's actually doing it or doing the thing that you imagine. So, you know, this is a classic thing. So, the classic approach. And people are very, you know, people are very interested in this question of: does my model have an inherent political belief? Does maybe it's biased? You know, maybe my model is biased against professors. I don't like these models that are so biased against professors, right? So what I can do is I can look to see if I write a sentence about professors or something like that, or I write a sentence about me, and I wonder if it's keeping track of the fact that I'm a professor, right? So I'll take a bunch of texts that I've written and a bunch of texts that non-professors have written, and I'll ask if I probe that text. Can the model tell the difference between whether I'm a professor or whether I'm not a professor, just from my email or something? Like that would be like evidence that it's biased against professors, right? Because it knows, it's keeping track of the fact that it's different, right? And I could train up one of these probes, and what if I got this hit? What if I found out the probe is super accurate? If you go to layer 15 of the last token of my email, I can classify the difference between professor and non-professor email at like 99.9% accuracy. It's like shouting red. It's like completely there, the information of whether it's a professor or not, right? Does that mean that the model is like thinking about, is this person a professor? I'm going to be biased against him or something? It's not necessarily, right? And the information might be there, but it might be that the model doesn't actually use the information for anything. And it might be a spurious correlate. I mean, it might be that it's paying attention often. So, you know, what is it like that I'm probing out? It's like maybe the probe recognized that, you know, the model cares if I'm writing things about having lots of fundraising meetings and other boring professor stuff or whatever, right? You know, just like all sorts of stuff, right? And it's just keeping track of all sorts of other things. And it just happens to be that I can aggregate all those signals and get like a 99% accuracy on like, am I a professor or not? You know, is that a concept inside the model, or is that just an aggregate classification result that you can get if you probe a thing? So anyway, that's the answer to the question. The answer is no. Right. Okay, so, and then Ananya had a different way of asking the question.
Yeah, but I think you answered it.
No, I like your question better.
What was your question?
I don't remember, but I remember thinking.
Oh, too late. Okay, then you don't get the answer. Okay, well, no. So, you asked it a slightly different way. What did you say?
Yeah, I guess that, like, I know this is what the paper spoke about for, like, correlational probes.
Yes.
Kind of also asked, like, but which is like understanding whether like the information exists, but then,
right.
Like, again, causal probe. I would imagine is like, how does it use?
What would a causal probe be?
Yeah.
Yes, and I forgot. I was going to stick in another slide for what a causal probe is, and I didn't have time to come back to add this slide for you. So, but. I'll point you at a couple papers. So, like, so you can probe a model to see if you can get a classifier out to do things, but you can also train an intervention on a model that asks, what is the optimal intervention that I can do that optimizes for some causal effect? And it's sort of a dual for a probe. It's sort of a causal probe. And there's been a couple papers written that suggest this kind of thing. So the two that I would suggest is there's a paper called amnesic probing. Like amnesia, if we got something. So maybe Nikhil can remember amnesic probing. We'll put that link in the Discord for people, if people are interested in trying that technique on their thing for causal probe. And then the other thing that people do is they do something called a distributed alignment search, where instead, so like in a probe, you're looking for what subspace, like what vector you can dot product by something to give you the most accurate classifier. But you can also do an intervention search. You can say what vector or what subspace is there where if I were to perturb things in the direction of that subspace, it would maximize certain causal effects. And so that general scheme, people figure out how to operationalize that, and they call it distributed alignments. So that's another thing. They're not as well established as probes, since you know people who are advocating try these things. You know, I think the jury is still out on them. But if you're into it, you can give it a try. Okay, so the TCAP paper and spurious features. Okay, Rice, what was the question about spurious features? I don't remember. What was your question?
I think I was asking about, I think you touched upon like the questions just a little bit, but I was just asking like when features like coexist and like they have correlation with each other, and when you have like relational probes rather than causal probes, would you like to like learn something else that make your prediction on this particular feature accurate, but like you're actually learning something else.
Right. And what does it look like? So I'll come back to that in a second. Actually, I'm gonna answer Armina's question a little bit more at first, because I did have this slide. I'm remembering now why I put these things in here.
Okay, so sorry, Ananya. So the question. So here's, so for a causal probe, actually the paper that you read, TCAV, is a little bit causal.
So, because it has two steps. First, it gets this probe direction, right? By just doing regular linear, you know, classification training. But then once you have this classifier, they don't just recommend just reporting the accuracy, which is what most, that's a standard thing to do with probes, is you just train this thing, and then you take a holdout set that you didn't train on, and then you just report accuracy on that thing. And then that tells you like how much this information is present. That's the normal formula. But what they do in TCAP is they say, no, actually, what you're really interested in is how much, like the concept of stripiness, it might be present, but we want to know how much it's used in the classification of zebras, right? And so what they do is they say, if you took this gradient, if you take like perturbations of the representation, how much does it change the prediction of zebra? Right, so that's basically what this gradient is. Basically, we've got the predictions of zebra, and we're asking, what is the gradient? What is the derivative of the prediction of zebra with respect to vector changes in the representation? So that gives you like, you know, how much the change in the representation changed zebra, and then you dot product it with this stripy direction that you got from the probe. And so what this is really telling you is, if we made a perturbation, if things were a little bit more stripy, right? If you made a perturbation in like this concept of a strike, then how much would that proportionally change your score for zebra? Would it push it up? Would it push it up a little? Would it push it up a lot? And so whatever this number is, that's like the TCAF score of like how much stripes are thought of as causing zebras. That makes sense? So because that's like maybe I want to know if like being a professor leads to bias against me. So I have a different sentence that says, you know, do you like this person or not? Yes or no, right? And I'm looking for no, like the model doesn't like this person. And then I put this professor email before it, and I like train a classifier on all the professor emails and stuff like that. And then now what I want to know is not just like, is the probe accurate, like can it tell if it's a professor or not, but then I also want to see if I bump it in that direction to make it think it's a professor, how much is it saying, you know, adjusting the prediction, no, right? How much is it making me say, no, I don't like this person? So then I would say, yes, you know, the model has this class of things that it doesn't like, and one of the major signals that it uses in that class is whether you're a professor or not. Your professor really doesn't like you. And I can compare it to other things. Like if you like ice cream, it does like you. Stuff like that. That makes sense? So this is what the TCAV proposal is. TCAV is, you know, a well-read paper. It's not a bad technique to try if you want to try to attach some causality. But also, for more modern takes, because TCAV is old, we might look at the other papers that I mentioned. But this is one way of getting causality out. Yes. Now Bryce has a question. Right. So this, right. Yes.
Sorry, I was following up on what you said.
Yes.
I was just wondering how effective are like gradient-based interpretations on LLMs?
Right. Right.
Like, for example, I suspect like a lot of tokens might have like non-zero gradients.
Yes.
When it comes to like noise.
Yes. Yes. I think that it may be controversial. After spring break, I'm going to see if I can get Gabriel to come talk about salience methods, which are very, very gradient based. And I think he's a believer that they have a lot of value on LLMs. And so I'll let him like give you the optimistic point of view. I think that the pessimistic point of view is that these systems are trained on this very discrete data. So maybe a little different from like image classifiers, where images are kind of continuous data. But like in really discrete data, it's not as clear that the gradient is as informative as it is in images. On the other hand, you know, what else do we have, right? So the other thing that we have is we could do a non-minuscule perturbation. We can actually change something in the direction, like really, really substitute in a thing, which is what patching is. And so that's why I mostly recommend people do patching. That makes sense. It's the equivalent. Okay, or steering is the equivalent of this, but in macroscopic terms. So now the other Red's question was about spurious features. So I wanted to tell you a story. How much time do we have? 15 minutes. Okay, so story time. Story time. This is about a paper I'm very proud to have helped out on, and a mistake that we made in the paper. So a research mistake. I'll fess up to here on video. Okay. So this is kind of today's paper, and it's about emergent world representations. And the idea is, it's about concepts. It's about like, does a model have a concept inside? And here's the basic setup. The setup is, let's say you were playing Othello, and with your friend, and every day you play Othello, but your friend is very loud and formal about Othello. So every time, what your friend says is, he says, when we play, I want you to shout out the move that you make. I'm going in C4. Okay, I'm going B3. Okay, C6. So you just shout these moves out really quickly, and then you play the whole game. And then one day, you're playing, and then there's this odd sound. You hear this bird going like C6. C6, C6, right? And outside there's this crow that's learned how to imitate your games. And oddly enough, right, when you look at the crow, right, it's you know, you say D3, And the crow is thinking, you know, C5, B6, E3, right? It's like, what actually, you, when you go and you listen to the crow and you realize it's actually emitting valid games. And after you say a bunch of games to it, right, the odd thing is it will always tell you another valid Othello move after you've done this. So if you had come across a strange crow, it could utter valid Othello moves on every word that it said, it would lead you to this question. Does the crow know what Othello is? Right? It's just like, listen to these words. Does it have, like, what? So what you call it is you call it a world model, right? Not just like a single binary concept, but like, does a crow have like a complete coherent idea of what Othello is? Does the crow like know in its head like what the game board is? And certainly if you like went outside and looked at the crow and it was standing there on top of an Othello board and it was like pushing little seeds around, then you'd be like, oh yeah, it knows. It knows. But if it was just saying it, then like how do you know whether the crow knows what Othello is? So one way of knowing is to use probes. Right? And here's how the probing would work. And this is what we did in our paper, right? We went to the crow, which obviously is a 8-layer autoregressive transformer. and then went to the crow, and we went into its brain, went to each layer, and we said, at this layer, I wonder if it knows whether this square here is occupied by a black stone or a white stone in Othello, right? And there are 64 squares, and so there's 64 probes. Like, I wonder if we can get like high accuracy probes for all 64 squares. So this collection of 64 probes is like a world model of Othello. And if you can get high accuracy on all of them, then definitely this model has like not only information about Othello, but like the whole board mapped out. That makes sense? Is that cool? So that's like another example of like what you might look for. Like the mapping people might look for things like this, right? It's just like this, right? And I'll tell you, this is what we found. We trained a whole bunch of probes, and here's like the 64 probes, and you get the little vectors for the probe, and they're arranged in these cool geometries all over the place. But the cool thing about the geometry is not just the geometry. It's like these probes are like 91% accurate, 98% accurate. They're pretty good, right, if you train the probes. But we train the probes two different ways. When we trained the probes, we train nonlinear probes, we can get 98% accuracy, which like, tells the story that we wanted to tell. We wanted to tell the story. These transformers have a world model, right? It's like looking inside the crow and you see a little Othello board in there. It's amazing, right? But the sad reality is that when we actually did this experiment, I kept on hounding Kenneth to train linear probes and get linear probes to work. And the highest accuracy he could squeeze out was like 79%, which is like rounding up. Yeah, I think that like he's probably more at 75%, right? And so, but like he, like the most you get out of linear probes is 79%. So like 20% of the time, 25% of the time, they're wrong, right? Which is not that convincing for such a simple problem where it's just classifier between white and black, right? It's like, it's just only like a bit better than random, right? You wanna be in the 90%. And so, He had to write this text in the so we did this. We made an MLP instead. So what's wrong with a multi-layer perceptron? Who doesn't like multi-layer probes? Who? You don't like multi-layer probes. who that you read doesn't like multi-layer probes? I'll give you a hint. We already read Bean Kim's paper. We talked about that. So who was the other paper? Hewitt. Yeah, Hewitt doesn't like multi-layer probes. And I'll tell you why in a minute, but I'll tell you why through the story first, right? Okay, so this is like in the appendix or something. Here's like the error rate for Othello on linear probes. It's sitting in the 25% range. Like it's pretty bad, right? For such a simple problem, right? Yes. 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, so the upshot is, after we publish this paper, like a month later, Neil Nanda posts his blog post And it says, actually, there's a linear probe that works. And he says, if you use a linear probe, here are the accuracies you get. And where white is like zero, right? Or like, you know, near zero. And blue is like 50%. It's like near the edge, you can get some potential. The reason that we're up to 25% is because, oh, maybe the edge we're better at guessing, but like in the middle, it's like zero. Like you can't get any accuracy or 50%. Right? So it's like random, right? But then he says, hey, but look, if I take this classifier and I don't train it on whether it's white or black on every move, but if I train it whether it's white or black on every other move, here's accuracy, like 100%, right? Every other move. And if I train the classifier, but I flip its parity, so it's not answering whether it's white or black, but it's answering whether that square is occupied by the person to move or the person to play, or the person's opposite, right? Then it's also 100%. So we had trained the wrong classifier. We were training the classifier on white or black, when the right classifier was, is a square occupied by the person to move or the opponent, right? It's flipping. And so so neural network people will tell you, to convert from a flip thing to not flip thing is an XOR function, and XOR is the thing that you can't implement in a single layer neural network, so you need a second layer to do it. So the whole reason you need a second layer is to implement this XOR function so that you can convert from one to the other. It's like a total waste. Anyway, so Hewitt says, don't use MLPs. MLPs have this overfitting problem. Oh, we have a lot of those questions to get through. Maybe I'll talk about it next time. But the way to read the Hewitt paper is that, like, this is his bottom line. The green line is linear probes. And Hewitt is saying, what you really want is you want things that are selective, that they're surprisingly good. You want something that's surprisingly good. You don't want something that was really hard to extract the information out of. And here, this green line is always surprisingly good. It's like floating above these other classifiers that you had to train so hard to get something out of. And so Hewitt's takeaway is that accuracy is not the point of a probe. You're not trying to get the most accuracy, right? Like it's the surprise. It's like how much unexpected accuracy you have, like better than some baseline. So Hewitt suggests some baseline, and he says the gap between those accuracies is what is called selectivity. So it's an important point to get. I can talk about it a little more next time. But yeah, that's the story of probes, right? Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of the lack of.